The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's issue of Time Magazine is dated December 6/December 13, 2021. Time, the letters in large block capitals, is a grayish white superimposed upon a grayish green background. The portrait on the cover is that of Frances Haugen, the making of a whistleblower. And she has grayish-green eyes. She's looking directly into the camera, wearing a grayish-green jacket. And she has long blonde hair parted on the right side. That article was read last week about Frances Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower. Beginning today with this article, this is the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, Russia's uncertain game on the Ukrainian border. In recent weeks, Russia has advanced more than 100,000 soldiers to its border with Ukraine. The Ukrainian government, fearing an attack, has called on Europe and the U.S. for help. A Kremlin spokesperson says Russia poses no threat to anyone, but its 2014 invasion of Crimea and its ongoing material support for separatist rebels in Ukraine's Donbas region, along with related denials of the same, have European and U.S. officials on alert. EU chief Ursula von der Leyen insists the EU and U.S. fully support the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and together they're publicly discussing retaliatory steps, mainly sanctions, if Russia crosses the border. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said a Russian incursion would be a serious mistake, and the U.S. has reportedly shipped some 80 tons of ammunition to Ukraine to support Kyiv. That's K-Y-I-V. What is Vladimir Putin up to? In recent years, the Russian president has fully embraced Cold War-style anti-Western words and actions, at least in part as a means of boosting his sagging approval ratings. A poll published in October by Moscow's Levada Center found Russian trust in Putin had fallen to 53%, its lowest level since 2012. History shows that picking fights with Ukraine can help with that. Russian troops, Putin claims, are responding to Western provocations in the Black Sea, where NATO has recently staged unannounced military exercises. Why should Russia, he asks, ignore the hostile presence of U.S. and European warships and fighter planes so near Russia's coastline? It is also possible Putin is signaling to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky not to try to boost his own slumping ratings by becoming more militarily aggressive with the Donbas rebels in coming months. Despite all this, a Russian invasion of Ukraine remains unlikely. 7 years ago, when Putin grabbed Crimea in retaliation for the political upheaval in Kyiv that forced Ukraine's pro-Russia president to flee the country, his troops were entering the only part of Ukraine where a majority of citizens were ethnic Russians. That guaranteed a mostly friendly reception. At the time, the Kremlin also had the element of surprise. The subsequent Russian backing for Ukraine's Donbas separatists likewise took place on mostly friendly territory. Today's Putin's aggressions have permanently poisoned the attitudes of tens of millions of Ukrainians toward Moscow. That is why any Russian advance into new Ukrainian territory would prove extremely costly for Russia. Ukraine cannot defeat Russia on the ground, and NATO would not join the fighting. But heavy Russian casualties and the financial costs of holding hostile territory are too politically expensive for a Russian president who is not as popular as he used to be. In fact, another Levada poll has found that though Russians tend to blame the West for trouble in Ukraine, they do not think a full-scale war with Ukraine would go well for Putin's domestic standing. All that said, Ukraine is in no position to ignore the sudden, expanded presence of Russian troops along its border, and U.S. and European officials know that any less than forceful statement of their support can make hostile Russian action more likely. The risk of war remains low, but no one will relax until those Russian soldiers step back. Here's a short column under History, a great chief. During the late 16th century, a great American Indian chiefdom arose along North America's mid-Atlantic coast. The people who lived along the rivers and shores of the Chesapeake Bay named it Senecomaca, densely inhabited land. I will spell that since I may have mispronounced it. T-S-E-N-A-C-O-M-M-A-C-A-H. Pieced together by two of the most powerful chiefs of the era, Powhatan and his brother Opechancanough, the chiefdom was a means of defending their territories from invasions by colonizers. Having been taken by Spanish mariners to Spain in 1561 and then living in Spanish America for many years, Opechancanough was well aware of the threat Europeans posed to his people. Initially, relations between the English and Powhatans, as the Indians were called, were friendly. Both sides were interested in trade, and the English were largely dependent on the Powhatans for food. But within a few years, relations broke down. Led by Opechancanough, Powhatan warriors would be engaged in hostilities for much of the first half of the 17th century. These attacks soon escalated into a war that nearly wiped out the English before hundreds of well-armed soldiers, veterans of wars in Europe, arrived and carried out devastating countermeasures. In the end, Opechancanough could not save his people from the sheer numbers of arrivals flooding into Virginia. Following his capture and death in 1646, resistance was broken. Yet he came closer than any of his peers to ridding his lands of Europeans. That column was adapted from A Brave and Cunning Prince, The Great Chief Opechancanough and the War for America by James Horn, H-O-R-N. Here's the view in box. Climate is Everything by Aaron Baker, senior correspondent. At the COP26 conference, there was a lot of grumbling among activists that official venues served meat, even if it was locally sourced. Animal agriculture has an outsized impact on global warming, up to 14.5% of annual global CO2 emissions. But in Glasgow, the meal included a lesson in carbon footprint economics by listing the emissions tally for each item. The meal carbon counts at COP26 were provided by Climato, K-L-I-M-A-T-O, a Swedish startup that analyzes the carbon footprint of food items so food service facilities can display the climate impact of their food offerings. Making climate-conscious choices when figuring out what to have for dinner is not particularly difficult, says Anton Unger, Climato's CEO and co-founder. The problem is that most people have no idea what the carbon footprint of their meal is. Climato uses a life cycle analysis that looks at CO2 emissions from both production and distribution on an ingredient-by-ingredient basis to come up with a final emissions total for a meal. Other companies are starting to do the same for consumer products, but it is not clear whether carbon labels would work in the wider world because it is very hard to understand agriculture's emissions impact within the framework of personal choice. Consumers already understand that taking the bus is better for the climate than driving, but food has a lot of variables. How do you weigh the carbon reductions of locally sourced meat against imported vegetables? Climato and other companies can help consumers make better choices. Space Time by Jeffrey Kluger, K-L-U-G-E-R, editor at large. There's a photo here. It is not credited, but it's the photo of, the Earth's moon, with another moon, and it's perhaps the Earth in the very far distance. The background's black, and these other orbital bodies are in shades of gray, except for the one way at the back that is only showing a slice, like a crescent moon slice, and it's in deep blue and white, which I'm guessing is the Earth. But anyway, the caption reads, Kamo Oaleva, Earth's quasi-moon. May not stick around for long. Everyone knows Earth only has one moon, or not. In fact, there's another sort of kind of moon found in 2016. And thanks to a new study in communications, Earth, and environment, we now know its origin story. The quasi-moon, named Kamo Oaleva, after a Hawaiian word for a moving celestial object, measures less than 50 meters, 164 feet across, and orbits Earth in a corkscrew trajectory that ranges from 40 to 100 times the 384,000 kilometer or 239,000 mile distance of our more familiar moon. Its odd flight path is caused by the competing gravitational pulls of Earth and the Sun, which continually bend and torque the moonlet's motions, preventing it from achieving a more conventional orbit. At first glance, the moonlet seems like nothing more than an asteroid, but asteroids tend to reflect brightly in certain infrared frequencies, and Kamo Oaleva does not. To investigate that mystery, University of Arizona grad student Ben Sharkey turned to a monocular telescope he says could squeeze every last ounce of photons out of that object. But its infrared signature remained stubbornly off. At last, the answer suggested itself. One of Sharkey's advisors once published a paper on lunar samples collected by Apollo astronauts. When Sharkey compared his telescope data with that earlier research, the results matched perfectly. The odd rock was clearly once part of Earth's main moon. How did Kamo Oaleva shake free? The moon's been getting bombarded by space rocks for billions of years, resulting in all manner of lunar debris getting ejected into space. Kamo Oaleva is one such piece of lunar rubble, but rather than simply tumbling off into the expanse, it found itself a quasi-satellite in its own right. Given its unstable orbit, the little moon will not stick around for long. Sharkey and others estimate it will remain an earthly companion for only about 300 more years, after which it will break free of its current gravitational chains and twirl off into the void. Originally a part of the moon, than a companion of Earth, it will spend the rest of its long life traveling on its own. From the brief news with the heading Nation, blame COVID-19 for a travel ban on dogs. Marine Sergeant John Weldon was deployed in Syria when a local left a days-old puppy at his military base in mid-May. To save the newborn, which was barely bigger than a human hand, the infantryman nursed him every 2 to 3 hours with a mixture of condensed milk, egg yolk, water, and yogurt, using a medical breathing tube and a syringe. The two had bonded by the time the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, announced that starting in July, dogs from more than 100 countries, including Syria, would be banned from entering the U.S. for at least a year due to rabies concerns. In January, the ban will become tighter as the number of airports accepting overseas dogs drops from 18 to 3, Los Angeles, Atlanta, and New York. I just want to get my dog home, says Weldon, 30, who was pulled out of Syria in August before he could arrange transport for the puppy he named Sully. He's now home in California while SPCA International cares for Sully overseas. Like many of life's disruptions over the past 20 months, the pandemic is largely responsible for the predicament facing Weldon and countless other humans and animals. In 2020, as U.S. pet adoptions emptied shelters, sellers overseas capitalized on the demand and sent over hundreds of puppies with falsified vaccination records, according to the CDC. In June, a rescue dog flown in from Azerbaijan with undetected rabies made its way to a family in Pennsylvania, where it came into contact with at least a dozen people before testing positive and being euthanized, officials say. The incident sparked the largest multi-state rabid dog import investigation in U.S. history. The dog travel ban is meant to prevent people and pets from canine rabies, a fatal, fast-spreading variant for which there is no cure. Globally, dog rabies kills about one person every 9 minutes, says Dr. Emily Pieracci, a veterinary epidemiologist with the CDC. It is less feared in the U.S., where it's been eliminated since 2007, but just one infected dog could undo decades of progress while creating a cascade of new public health risks. There are some exceptions. On an extremely limited basis, the CDC says it would issue import permits to allow Americans to fly in dogs from high-risk nations. But applying for them has not been easy. The application is extremely vague and frustrating, Weldon says, having twice been rejected despite having help from SPCA International, which has reunited more than 1,200 pets with soldiers over the past 13 years. But he is undeterred. The conditional love a dog gives you is unlike any other, Weldon says. I won't ever quit. Melissa Chan wrote that article, and the next article is under the heading World, Russia's Anti-Satellite Test Threatens ISS. The Russian military conducted a missile test November 15 that obliterated a dead satellite and generated a cloud of debris in outer space that forced astronauts aboard the International Space Station, ISS, to temporarily take shelter. As thousands of pieces of the satellite began to spread, the U.S., German, and Russian astronauts aboard were instructed to climb into their Soyuz and Dragon capsules in case they needed to evacuate. Brian Whedon, a former Air Force officer and expert in space security at the Secure World Foundation, said the situation could have been catastrophic because of the high speeds involved. objects in space tear through the cosmos at up to 17,500 miles per hour, which means that even a marble-sized piece of debris poses a danger. A collision with an object several centimeters in size or higher could rupture the space station, potentially harming or endangering astronauts on board, Whedon explains. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby told reporters Russia's anti-satellite ASAT test was an irresponsible act and indicated a troubling trend. We watch closely the kinds of capabilities that Russia seems to want to develop, which could pose a threat not just to our national security interest, but the security of other spacefaring nations, Kirby said. Several countries, including the U.S., China, India, and now Russia, have tested ASAT missiles by blasting their obsolete satellites apart. Earlier in November, the ISS was forced to fire up its thrusters and raise its altitude by about a mile in order to avoid a lingering piece of a weather satellite China blew up in a 2007 test, which was on target to come uncomfortably close. That marked the 29th time the station has been forced to bob and weave to stay out of harm's way since 1999, and it will not be the last. Russia's test marks the latest contentious development in space, which has become a new theater of hostilities between world powers. A flurry of advancements by the U.S., Russia, and China has altered the image of outer space as a peaceful sanctuary, and instead stoked fears that an arms race has extended into the heavens. That article was written by W.J. Hennigan, with reporting by Jeffrey Kluger. Lifestyle, and this column is written by Katie Lang. Single people today care less about looks. Emotional maturity tops the list of what U.S. singles are looking for, beating out all other qualities, according to a new study by the dating site Match, released November 9. It is one of many recent shifts in dating trends that show singles are reconsidering their relationship priorities in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. In addition to a move toward an interest in emotional maturity, the study found singles are less concerned with finding someone who is considered physically attractive. In 2020, 90% of singles ranked physical attractiveness as an important quality. This year, only 78% did. Being open-minded and accepting of differences was important to 83% of respondents. Being a good communicator was a high priority for 84%. The effect of the pandemic on these cultural changes cannot be emphasized enough, according to Helen Fisher, Match's chief science advisor, who says trends emerging because of COVID-19 have the potential to impact how we date and form partnerships forever. A need for security and stability was especially apparent in the survey. Singles indicated their desire for a financially stable partner was nearly 20% higher this year than over the past 2 years. The desire for a partner with a similar level of education and successful career rose 10% and 5%, respectively, since 2019. A majority of singles reported being eager to be off the market. The sooner, the better. The study found only 11% of singles want to date casually, while 62% said they're looking for meaningful and committed relationships. Urgency has also become a factor. 65% of those surveyed, especially Gen Z and millennial singles, said they wanted a relationship within the next year. And while the importance of putting a ring on it increased by nearly 20% this year, over the past 2 years for all singles, men across the board had a more significant increase. 22% more men indicated that they now want to get married, compared with 14% more women. Fisher also notes singles are looking to find more meaning in not only their romantic partnerships, but also in their independent lives, working on themselves and prioritizing their physical and mental health. This is a historic time in human courtship, she tells Time. I am not surprised that those that came out of it alive grew up. COVID-19 questions. This is a very small column written by Jamie Ducharme. Can you mix and match your COVID-19 booster shot? With COVID-19 boosters now authorized for all U.S. adults, many people are planning their next shots. Preliminary research is clear. Mixing and matching vaccine boosters produces a safe immune response similar to or stronger than an additional dose of your original shot. Studies have not yet compared different combinations of vaccines, so it is difficult to recommend one type of booster over another, but data do show people who originally got the Johnson & Johnson shot produced more antibodies when boosted with a dose of Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna. For people who got a two-dose vaccine to begin with, Jason Pogue, an infectious disease clinical pharmacist at Michigan Medicine, says the choice is a bit less important. If it's more comfortable to get the one you got the first time, then go ahead, he says. But if that shot is not in stock when you go to the pharmacy, it is totally reasonable to get the one that is available. If you're not sure which booster to get, Dr. Mohamed Sobhani, an infectious disease physician at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, recommends talking to a physician who can take into account your specific circumstances. And of course, if you have not gotten vaccinated at all yet, doing so is a very good idea. The original shots are still working well to prevent severe disease and death. Boosters are just another way to protect the vulnerable. This article is under the heading Nation. A charter school's racial controversy illustrates the real battle for America's classrooms by Molly Ball, Malden, Massachusetts. Eric Henry could not believe what the fifth graders at his triplet school were being assigned to read. January 31, the electrical engineer and Navy veteran fired off an email to a group of fellow parents and activists in the Boston suburb of Malden. Remote learning has given us added insight into what stands for instruction based on American culture, Henry wrote. The banning of this text from the curriculum should be a plank in our platform. The book in question was The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, Mark Twain's 1876 classic of American literature, a work approved by the state of Massachusetts as part of the public school curriculum. But when Henry's missive reached an employee at the agency that oversees Mystic Valley Regional Charter School, the official agreed with his complaint. This is horrible, wrote Olympia Stroud, a program coordinator at the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, DESE. How long have these books been in the curriculum? Stroud forwarded the concerns to a supervisor, Benny Capitolin, who called the matter heartbreaking. If our system cannot protect black and brown students from unsafe environments, Capitolin wrote, how can it possibly educate them? For 23 years, Mystic Valley's academic record has been undeniable. Its students are disproportionately lower-income kids from communities of color, yet its test scores and graduation rates routinely rank among the state's best. Charter school rankings place it in the top percentiles nationally. The school's 1,500-person wait list is nearly as large as its K-12 enrollment, and attrition is so low, few students are admitted past kindergarten. Under Massachusetts law, charter schools, which are publicly funded but privately operated, are supposed to be judged solely on their academic success, faithfulness to their charter, and organizational viability. But Mystic Valley's future as an institution is now in doubt because of an approach to teaching that has fallen out of fashion. The school's educational mission focuses on the fundamental ideas of our American culture, with an emphasis on the nation's founding documents. As set out in its state-approved charter, it aims to embrace the melting pot theory by highlighting our citizens' and students' commonality, not their differences. Yet to avoid perpetuating racism, many educators, administrators, and parents now believe it is insufficient to ensure everyone is treated the same. A few years ago, as national debates about racism and history intensified, DESE added a new cultural responsiveness standard to its evaluation of charter schools, defined as an approach to viewing culture and identity as assets, in order to acknowledge and actively draw upon diverse backgrounds and identities. To Mystic Valley, this new criterion seemed like an attempt to impose race consciousness on a proudly egalitarian school. When administrators expressed concerns that its charter was incompatible with the new cultural standards, the state insisted there was no issue. Yet in May, when regulators conducted an interim performance review, they informed the school it was only partially conducive to learning because of its approach to culture and identity. A draft report issued in September marked the school as not fully meeting the new standard. Mystic Valley has sued the state over the cultural responsiveness criteria, which it fears could put its charter in jeopardy. Such reviews are supposed to be unbiased and free of outside influence, but according to a trove of emails the school obtained through a public records lawsuit, DESE employees were secretly coordinating with the school's critics, including the Henrys, the NAACP, and local racial justice activists, unconnected to the school. The critics appeared to strategize with the state officials to go after Mystic Valley. In their emails, the activists advocated a stealth approach using cloak-and-dagger tactics, and DESE went along, adding employees to the review team who were concerned about the school's racial climate, then deliberately delaying the review for months to allow parents to submit official complaints. When none materialized, the department created informal focus groups that they packed with the same complaining activists, then incorporated the group's feedback into its report, the documents show. In another email, Stroud praised the activists for their work to help expose Mystic Valley. DESE declined to comment, citing the school's pending lawsuit. The state attorney general's office is also reviewing complaints of alleged racial discrimination at Mystic Valley, according to a spokeswoman. Other parents at the school, many of them working-class people of color, who see it as their child's best chance at success, are disturbed by the conflict. Many are terrified Mystic Valley will be forced to close. We have always been evaluated with flying colors, says Alex Dan, the school's director, a former English teacher and swimming coach. But now there's this vague mandate to follow a new approach that we feel is the opposite of what has made us so successful as a school and wonderful as a country. The teaching of race in American schools has become a front-burner political issue. New laws regulating curricula have passed from coast to coast, and education was a dominant topic in Virginia's recent gubernatorial election, which saw Republican candidate Glenn Youngkin write a critique of state policy to an upset. Yet the debate has generated more heat than light, with conservatives charging students are being brainwashed with critical race theory, while liberals insist they merely want the teaching of history to better reflect the country's complicated past. The Mystic Valley controversy helps illustrate both arguments are misleading, or at least incomplete. What is really at issue is not the past, but the future. how the next generation of Americans are taught to regard their own identities in relation to society and their peers. What Mystic Valley's proponents and critics agree on is that its colorblind approach is at the heart of the controversy. Their view is, we are a melting pot. There are no racial differences, no cultural differences. Essentially, as long as you accept white culture, you're fine, says Greg Bartlett, secretary of the local NAACP branch. Students of color may be getting good test scores, but they're not safe, he says. In my judgment, the school is not overly racist, but it is clear there's a lot of hurt going on. For as long as there has been an America, scholars have debated the tension between assimilation and multiculturalism. Race neutrality and race consciousness. How to make a single neutral set of rules for a nation whose very constitution deemed some inhabitants to have a fraction of the personhood of others, a land founded on immigration, genocide, and bondage, held together not by an identity, but an ideal. In recent years, many Americans have become aware that equal rules can have unequal outcomes. A textbook example occurred at Mystic Valley in 2017. To ensure parity among students, the school has a strict dress code. It mandates uniforms and forbids makeup, jewelry, and other forms of ornamentation. But the policy against hair extension had a disproportionate impact on black girls. 15-year-old twins Maya and Deanna Cook pointed out, for them, box braids were not an indulgence. They were a way to transition from treated to natural hair. School officials say the controversy was merely a misunderstanding. As a middle-aged white guy, despite having done civil rights work for 30 years, I was ignorant to the importance of hair extension to women of color, says Howard Cooper, a liberal Boston lawyer who's argued civil rights cases for the ACLU and is now representing Mystic Valley in its lawsuit against the state. Once the school understood the rule's disproportionate effect, Cooper says, it voluntarily changed the policy, expanded the role of its civil rights coordinator, and mandated diversity training for all employees. The following year, its charter was renewed without incident. After the May 2020 murder of George Floyd, a group of alumni circulated a petition to make MVRCS an actively anti-racist school, urging it to restructure the mission statement and handbook to address issues of systemic discrimination. At a virtual meeting of the school's Board of Trustees, June 8, 2020, parents and alums demanded to know why the school had not responded to the tragedy or denounced Facebook posts by its co-founder and former board chair, Neil Kinnon, a former Democratic Malden City Councilman who shared a Wall Street Journal op-ed denying police racism. The board members announced no action in response to the complaints. Finally, June 16, Dan, Mystic Valley's director, wrote a letter to the school's family. Families, we recognize there has been and continues to be an unacceptable tolerance of racism by sections of our society, he wrote. It is our sincere hope that the current activism will yield true and productive results and lead to the fair and just treatment of those who have and continue to suffer for no other reason than the color of their skin. For many parents, this was insufficient. All these multi-billion dollar industries were finally saying Black Lives Matter, even NASCAR, says Zina Abu-Khalil Quinones, whose daughter was in first grade at the time. Why couldn't they stand up and say those words? A Puerto Rican Palestinian social worker, she was shocked to discover the school did not celebrate Black History Month. Her concerns deepened as she monitored her daughter's virtual lessons. In one second grade homework assignment, a multiple choice answer about Harriet Tubman identified her as a conductor on the Underground Railroad, as though she were merely operating a train. Abu Khalil Quinones says her daughter's now much happier at her local school. They talk about inclusion. They talk about feelings. It is not just memorization. For many years, Eric Henry was one of Mystic Valley's biggest boosters. My wife would ride around when she was pregnant saying, "That's where I'm going to send my kids," recalls Henry, who's black. As a military man, he especially loved the school's strict discipline. From the time the triplets started kindergarten, he was an enthusiastic member of the school community, serving on the parent-teacher organization, attending board meetings, even volunteering on Kinnon's political campaigns. But the Henrys began having reservations when a seventh-grade teacher persistently misspelled Dwayne's name. Then in eighth grade, Tora had a conflict with an English teacher that spiraled out of control. She was called insubordinate and accused of creating drama, charges she only ever saw directed to black students. My white classmates could be standing right there and I wouldn't even be doing anything, but I would be the one who got in trouble, says Tora, 16, who left Mystic Valley and now attends Malden High. Eric Henry says he once embraced the school's philosophy, but now finds it abhorrent. Now when I read them talking about their steadfast commitment to this concept of American culture, it makes me cringe to no end, he says. I hear people complain about critical race theory, but from my understanding, we need more of it. Isn't it just the truth to say there's systemic racism in America? I think in this society we fear those facts that are from the perspective of the victim. The controversy over assigning Mark Twain originated with Henry's friend, Saeed Coates, a black real estate investor with three daughters at Mystic Valley. Coates had never read Tom Sawyer before his eldest brother brought it home last winter. Perusing it, he was disturbed by the book's repeated use of the N-word. "My fifth grader should not be made to feel uncomfortable," Coates says. "I think it is insane they're exposing fifth graders to ethnic slurs." No children of other races, he pointed out, were subjected to a barrage of racist insults in their class readings, only black children. The questions underpinning the Mystic Valley controversy cut to the core of public education. What does it mean to prepare children to be citizens of the United States, to take their place in society, to be considered educated? And as society changes, when and how should those standards change in response? Life, liberty, and there's one more thing, the pursuit of something. Who can tell me what it is? It's almost dismissal time for Miss Gregory's fourth grade class, and the students sit in neat rows behind plastic COVID barriers as she roams the school looking for raised hands. The school draws inspiration from the core knowledge approach invented by E.D. Hirsch Jr., a scholar whose heavily scripted curriculum is controversial but has been shown to achieve high test scores. Susanna? Yeah, the pursuit of happiness, Gregory says. All right, let's do the next one. Why did George Washington cross the Delaware? A few weeks ago, Halloween was canceled at the public school district in nearby Melrose, Massachusetts. The superintendent announced that generic fall celebrations would better advance the goals of equity and inclusion. A backlash ensued, and Halloween was subsequently celebrated with such gusto at Mystic Valley that some liberal parents suspected it was an intentional swipe. It was an apt distillation of the vexing question facing American education today. To purge children's worlds of the things not everyone can share, or expose them all to the same thing, whether or not they can relate to it? And is there any neutral ground between the extremes? The answers to these questions may be existential for Mystic Valley. The school's lawsuit against DESE is pending, and the state board recently denied it a waiver from the new cultural responsiveness criteria. Several Democratic state legislators are pressuring the school to change. Mystic Valley officials believe the internal DESE emails they uncovered prove the fix is in, and the state's determined to find a pretext on which to revoke its charter, which is up for renewal in 2023. It would be a brutal irony, they say, if an institution with a track record of improving outcomes for children of color is shut down in the name of anti-racism. Rita Mercado, a Filipino-American government lawyer who lives in Melrose, is among the parents who believe in Mystic Valley's vision of inclusion. She sees a group of children from diverse backgrounds who are learning to get along without taking anyone's identity for granted. At an American Heritage performance her son took part in when he was in kindergarten, seeing 100 kids of different nationalities singing, "This land is your land," I remember thinking, this is what I envision America to be. Mercado's son, now 7, was not aware of the town's Halloween kerfluffle when he wrote a letter to his pen pal earlier in the fall. "Do you celebrate Halloween?" the second grader wanted to know. "And if so, what do you do?" Reading it, Mercado's heart swelled with pride. This sort of curiosity was instinctive to him. He knew from school that not everyone celebrates Christmas or Hanukkah or Diwali, so it made sense to ask. "Score one for these kids being more woke than me," she says. "It's the adults who are still trying to figure it all out." This article, which was abridged, was written by Molly Ball at Malden, Massachusetts, with reporting by Julia Zortian, New York. The View, The Future of Work, The New, More Relaxed Rules for Office Dressing by S. Mitra Kalita. We're all experiencing mirror anxiety. That's the term Stanford researchers give the negative emotions surfaced by watching ourselves all day long on video conference calls. Like so much of pandemic life and work, the way we see ourselves has changed. For workers returning in person with a new sense of beauty, style, and self, it can feel daunting to relearn how to navigate the norms of workplace dressing. But those have completely changed too, and workers now have more power than before to shape dress codes. For example, nearly half of U.S. consumers surveyed by Klarna Bank AB plan to wear more comfortable clothes when they go back to working in the office. People will remain uncompromising when it comes to their comfort, and companies will have to adjust to this transition, says Jennifer Gomez, co-founder and CMO of OneKin. That's O-N-E, and then in capital letters attached, K-I-N, an online marketplace for retailers and entrepreneurs of color. So that blazer thrown over a T-shirt, once perfect for video conference, is now appropriate for an in-person meeting at headquarters. Casual to dressy transformations like chunky earrings and bright lipstick applied just before a meeting starts are also here to stay, Gomez predicts. Even before the pandemic, work attire was trending toward athleisure, a hybrid style that feels appropriate for these hybrid times. Los Angeles-based stylist Quentin Fears says it is a go-to among his clients who now turn to him to help them get through big life events like new jobs and changes like weight fluctuations. He connects the current period of transition with a desire for comfort and coziness. Case in point, pants. The COVID-era world divides pants into two categories, soft and hard. The latter's losing. The parent company of Joe's Jeans recently filed for bankruptcy. True Religion, once known for its pricey denim, now has more of its business focused on hoodies, joggers, and T-shirts. Clients are still opting for softer khakis with elastic waistbands and other loose-fitting, comfy clothing, says Fears, even as offices reopen. Before, there was a stuffy sort of, "we all need to dress this one way," as part of what it means to be a professional, he says. You would assume someone wearing a suit has a lot of money. Now that's been flipped on its head. The guy in the hoodie makes just as much or maybe more. An important exception to the move toward casual office dressing is people of color. A Slack Future Forum survey found 81% of black respondents in the U.S. say they prefer a fully remote or hybrid workplace, which offers some relief from the microaggressions and extra scrutiny that come with in-person work, and the biases built into the norms, defined as professional appearance. People of color still have to prove themselves more, and it's still present in what you wear, says Fierce, who's black. White skin already gets you authority. White people can get away with being more relaxed. Women, too, are slower to embrace less formality. Klarna's survey found women are more likely to dress up than men. Three more trends strike Gomez as shifts in the way we now style ourselves. The first is prioritizing effortlessness over adherence to rules, looking like you tried, but not too hard. The second is a desire to buy local. And the third is increasing emphasis on a brand's values. Notably, a garment's backstory might be as important as its look. Is it something you feel good about wearing, both physically and ethically? It is a good lesson for the trend that stylists hope to see in the pandemic workplace, whether at home or in the office, to focus less on how others see you and more on how you see yourself. The author, S. Mitra Kalita, is a co-founder and CEO of URL Media, publisher of Epicenter NYC, and columnist for Charter in partnership with Time. This column is entitled Nine Questions. It's written by Simon Schuster. It will probably be abridged. Dmitry Muratov, Muratov, a winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize on Who Should Have Gotten It, the role of fear in Russian life, and why media freedom matters. Question, how did you cope with the murder of your star reporter, Anna Politkovskaya, 15 years ago? Answer, at that moment the newsroom had one feeling, and it abides today. It's the desire for revenge. We seek that revenge in the daily job of finding and exposing the truth. Question, what changed in your life after the Nobel? Answer, it feels like getting a magic wand that you don't quite know how to use. In the first few days after the Nobel Committee made an announcement, we got bundles of letters asking us for help. Help for people with disabilities. Help for people unjustly imprisoned. In our country, many people have started to see us as a place to turn. Question, what's the mood now among independent journalists in Russia? Answer, we see that a war is being waged against us, and as long as we're at war, competition gives way to solidarity. That does not mean we've stopped chasing scoops, but we do not see each other as competitors anymore. We have banded together. Question, keeping your newspaper alive has often forced you to negotiate with the state. How will the Nobel change those negotiations? Answer, my take on that question is pessimistic. My country likes to show that it could not care less about the world's judgments. The state's position is, we've got oil and gas, we've got rockets. So here's the deal. We live the way we want, and you mind your business or else we'll hit back. Given that lack of respect for the world's institutions, why would they respect an institution like the Nobel Prize? I don't see why. If anything, I see how it could become a liability for us. Question. You have said that if it had been your choice, you would have given the prize to Alexei Navalny, the imprisoned leader of the opposition movement. Why? Answer. He's faced his imprisonment stoically and courageously. He's shown us all how to have a backbone, how to have a sense of irony and humor, to be brave. These are qualities I hold in the highest regard. Question, what are the prospects for the opposition movement now in Russia? Answer, 30 years ago we were all enamored with democracy. Today it seems to me many people are enamored with dictatorship. In that sense, the context has changed a great deal. In 1989, millions of people marched through Moscow to end the Communist Party's monopoly on power. What happened to all those people? The answer is fear. fear has returned. Question. You have said media freedom is the antidote to dictatorship. Is it also an antidote to fear? Answer. It's a very strange paradox. We call on people to be brave, yet we publish truths that terrify them. We show them the machinery of the state, and we're obligated to show them how this machinery works. But the more honest and penetrating our investigations, the more people are afraid. Question. Since you founded Novaya Gazeta, several of its reporters have been killed. How does your newsroom deal with that level of danger? Answer. After enough time on this job, some dangers fade like sirens in the background. It is like we're used to living with a certain level of radiation in the air. We push it to the side. It becomes a part of life. Question. What do you see as the future of journalism? Answer. The Washington Post once had a source called Deep Throat. That era is gone. There are no more government insiders. They're too afraid of the state, the security services. Now we have journalists who know computer programming, who write code, who can extract what we need from big data. Huge collectives of journalists can do that work from anywhere. That is the future. Dmitry Muratov is pictured on this page, and we did finish all of the questions and answers. The photo is in black and white, or rather shades of gray, and darker shades of gray. He is dressed in probably black or very dark gray, a jacket over a vest over a turtleneck. We see just him from his pockets, his coat pockets, upward. He has a pale-looking face, but again, it's in shades of off-white and gray. He has a beard and more facial hair, mostly in grayish-white tones. Here it appears he has dark eyes, but it's unknown exactly. And he has hair on the top of his head, gray hair, parted on his left side and combed neatly. He's neither smiling nor frowning. It appears that his mouth is partially open so that he is speaking to the person interviewing him. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.